Broadcasting from deep within the second realm, you are listening to agoristradio.com.
Hello, this is Hero White of the Cypherpunk Show. Agoristradio.com is sponsored by MetroPie.net, SSH proxy and VPN services. Privacy is your right, only if you defend it. Please support our sponsors and tell others about them.
I know you're out there. I can feel you now. I know that you're afraid. You're afraid of us. You're afraid of change. I don't know the future. I didn't come here to tell you how this is going to end. I came here to tell you how it's going to begin. I'm going to hang up this phone, and then I'm going to show these people what you don't want them to see. I'm going to show them a world without you. A world without rules and controls, without borders or boundaries. A world where anything is possible.
Hello, welcome back to Cypherpunked. This is your host, Hero White, and today we have a special guest coming to us from across the great second realm, Mike Gogolski, a stateless ex-American. We're going to talk about that, living in Bratislava, Slovakia. And let's go, Mike, are you on there okay?
I'm here. How you doing?
Hey, all right. Thank you for coming on the show. Welcome. We've been wanting to get you on for quite a while.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Well, a lot of people aren't familiar with some of your work, so I'm going to throw out some of the references here. You are behind some of these sites, projects, nostate.com, gogolski.com, bitcoinlaundry.com, freedom-blogs.com, c4ss.org, and I see this app, bitlaundry.com. So why don't we start with these other blogs that you are running before we get into the Bitcoin stuff. So tell us about how you came to be a stateless ex-American and then with these blogs here.
Well, nostate.com is my political blog, and that's where I first announced, I guess in the middle of 2008, that I was going to renounce my U.S. citizenship and become stateless as a result. And that's what I did here in Bratislava. Went to the American embassy and handed in some papers. Got interviewed, I guess, to ensure that I wasn't crazy. And a few days later, went back and signed off and swore an oath and handed in a tax document. And after a few weeks, I had a certificate saying I was no longer a citizen. And my passport returned to me with holes punched in it and marked canceled.
Wow. Yeah, quite an experience. I remember following this on your blogs and your report. I think there's a lot of what is the site? Is it in gogolski.com that has a lot of your blog posts on this process and what you found?
Nostate.com is where to go. Gogolski.com is my my professional website for my my other career as a translator.
Oh, okay, great. What languages do you translate in?
I translate from Slovak into English mostly. Sometimes I do a little bit of Czech into English as well.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, that's nice. So, the nostate.com, what's the difference between that and the C4SS and the Freedom Blogs? You got all these things going on here. How do they cross over with each other?
Well, Freedom Blogs is a little service that I set up a couple of years ago to basically to host blogs for people, where I provide a standalone WordPress instance, which is more flexible than putting up something at WordPress.org or at Blogspot.com. Mm-hmm. In exchange for that service, if they get popular enough, then I run little text ads on them and, you know, taking a little bit of income that way.
Okay.
What kind of C4.
Let me hit a couple of questions on this. Are you charging for that service?
No, it's free.
Okay, and is there an application process? I mean, it's not just free web hosting. It's specifically geared toward people who want to put up some Liberty-related blog. Is that it?
It's geared in that direction, but it's not limited to that. You know, if somebody wants a WordPress site, all they have to do is contact me, and I'll put them online. And I think I'm hosting something like 20 now.
Oh, really? Is it possible for them to to use one of their own subdomains and get your, but still give you credit on the page?
Yeah, I've got there's several that use their own domains, including a daily online newspaper in English about Slovakia. There's an Italian language parallel service also about Slovak news. They all have their own names.
Okay.
And then there's a number also that have subdomains of freedomblogs.com.
Okay, great. Do you are you running like BuddyPress or some special version of WordPress, or
no? Each individual who sets up services with me gets their own account on the shared hosting server, and a discrete installation of WordPress for each site that I host for them.
Oh, okay, great. So it's not just like the WordPress main site where it's just one instance with all these accounts.
No, unfortunately, WordPress's multi-site capability doesn't extend to having a number of different domains. You can have a number of subdomains of one domain, but you can't have different domains entirely.
You know, I did some research on this because I was working on putting up a WordPress blog, and I recommended that the people not do it, but they wanted WordPress for some plugins and like. And they wanted a blog that was reachable through I2P, through Tor, as an, you know, onion, a .onion, .itp, mm-hmm. and through a regular domain name, and through one of the, like, I2P .2, you know, proxy gateways into the I2P2 system. And, man, I had an absolute nightmare, and I could not believe how WordPress is so set up and hard-coded to where to run a multiple domain system is just it's a project, and the stuff that's out there is just complete hacks, and most of them aren't even geared toward they're geared more toward like this running on multiple subdomains or something. It was quite a little experience. So that's
you'd have to set up like little HTTP rewriting proxies in between the different services and WordPress in order to get it to behave sanely.
Yeah, it's just surprising that, you know, there's 10,000 WordPress plugins out there and it's used everywhere, and the stuff is just not built into it. I mean, when I design web applications, that's one of the first things that I do is I make sure that nothing is tied to specific domain names. And it's becoming more important now when you're coding this stuff with jackboots seizing domain names and you know, stuff like that, that you want to be able to run your, it's a good idea not to tie your application to a specific domain name, even in your branding and marketing in the future. It's because of how that it could be seized, especially if you're doing something that's any, you know, controversial. So.
Absolutely, but that's not the use case that most of the WordPress development effort is going to address, obviously.
Yeah, right. Okay. Let's see. Well, we covered the freedom blogs. What about the you were going to continue with the C4SS?
C4SS is the Center for a Stateless Society. It's a website which publishes opinion pieces on commenting on the news from a market anarchist perspective. It's a project of the Molinari Institute, which is headed by Professor Roderick Long, and it's directed by Brad Spangler, who's also the owner of agorism.info. And I've been supporting the site as IT administrator now for about 2 years.
Oh, great. Super. And then we move up to I guess this is the Bitcoin. What's the difference here between the two sites before we jump into them? For me, between the BitcoinLaundry.com and the app.bitlaundry.com?
So BitcoinLaundry.com is something I created in the space of a couple hours a few months ago. And basically it's a single PHP script for the site, and then an even smaller PHP script for a cron job. And what it does is it allows you to enter an amount of Bitcoins and an address that you want the Bitcoin sent to. Then it generates a new address and presents it to you. And once you send Bitcoins to that address and they've been confirmed a couple of times, the cron job notices them in the wallet, deducts a little fee, and then sends another Bitcoin transaction out to the address that was submitted. So in theory, this makes the history more complicated to track because you've got another set of associations to trace through. Second, if the wallet has enough coins in it and if enough people are using the system at the same time, then there's a good chance that you could get different Bitcoins than the ones that you sent in.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, you know, let's get in. I want to ask you a bunch of questions about that. But before I do that, just very briefly, I see this app.bitlaundry.com. Now, are you doing this, and how is this different?
Well, app.bitlaundry.com was started sometime early last year, by another guy, and I acquired it from him. He put it up for auction on the Bitcoin forum, and I bought it. I said I want to monopolize the Bitcoin laundering marketplace.
Did you buy it with Bitcoin?
Of course.
Okay, I had to ask.
Yeah, of course. I bought it with Bitcoins, and it was a flat rate plus an ongoing commission up to a limit. So I took the code that I received and the domain and took control of everything, and then I ripped into it and substantially rewrote it. So it looks much the same on the front end as it was before. But I launched it last night in its new incarnation, and it's quite different. It's quite different from the other system in that it allows you to specify multiple recipient addresses and to set up a distribution scheme where the transactions will be spread out across multiple addresses over multiple days and with a specifiable number of transactions per day.
Yeah, this is great. We've been talking about using some of the old anonymous remailer techniques tied in with XMPP servers for doing messaging, you know, kind of anonymous remailers, but using Jabber clients. And this mm-hmm. is great because this is some of the same type of ideas of doing delays and sending stuff out. I see on this the page at listeners can go to app.bitlaundry.com. This is really great. It says tips. Send Bitcoins to yourself to obscure their history. Use multiple recipient addresses and or spread the transactions over a number of days to thwart correlation attacks. And down here on fees, let's see, it's 0.5% of the total you spend plus 0.002 BTC per outgoing transaction. So, and the example here says, let's distribute 1,000 Bitcoins to 4 recipients over 5 days with 3 transactions per recipient per day. And it gives the little fee structure here. This is fantastic.
Well, right at the moment, the actual capability of the site is not very high because the wallet balance that backs it up. For example, I'm not going to say what it is, but it's not sufficient to handle the 1,000 Bitcoin transaction that's given there as an example. You'd end up getting back a mix of the coins that you sent in plus coins that I already had in the server wallet. I'm looking at a couple of different ways to address that. One is I'm talking to one guy who might want to lend a pool of Bitcoins to the service from which he would draw a commission per transaction, basically a commission of my commission. Alternately, I'm thinking about integrating the service with some of the online systems that allow you to maintain a Bitcoin balance, yep. Such as the exchange website, mtgox.com, because they have large pools of Bitcoin already, and there's, you know, an excellent chance that when you send something in and then take something back out from one of those sites, you're going to get different Bitcoins. So that would make it a much stronger system either way.
Yeah, no. This is fantastic. This is a lot of ideas being thrown in here and mixed around that just are fantastic. And a lot of people have been talking about a lot of ways that this stuff can be done, because there's this big problem with Bitcoin where all transactions that happen within the Bitcoin system are traceable, but they're traceable to accounts, and those accounts can be public or they can be private. And I'm just giving some background for
sure
the listeners for some of the issues here, is that when you go out there and you publish on your website, here, send me this much money to this Bitcoin address, you are creating a situation where anyone can track the amount of money that you have received to that particular Bitcoin address.
Right.
And now, if you do what we talked about in the Loom API show, in the Loom API, a payment address or a payment location in the Loom system is accessible to anybody who has that payment ID location. So, and it's this huge, massive number, so it's not like something that someone can just guess. Now, so what happens in that system is if you put that up on your website, anyone pays to it, anyone can also be looking in there and grab the money out. It's sort of like a table like they say at the cash, there's a guy at the cash register, and you're the customer, you throw the money on the table. If anyone knows the location mm-hmm. of that, they can rip it out. So in the Loom system, what you want to do is every time someone comes, when you have a shopping cart or a system where you're in exchanging Loom assets, you want to have the backend API spit out a custom payment address for the customer at that point.
Right, and snatch the payment off the table as soon as it comes in.
Yep, exactly. Yep. Now, in this, that's why it's very important for people who are doing Bitcoin to APIs and shopping carts to understand that if you have this public address out there, all payments are going to be tracked to it. But if you do the same thing that they do in the Loom system, you can give every person a dynamic address to pay into the system.
That's right, and I've developed myself I think three different Bitcoin shopping cart plugins for different systems. There's one for VirtuMart running under Joomla. There's one for UberCart running under Drupal, and there's one for WP e-commerce running under WordPress. Based on the way that Bitcoin works, actually, to do commerce with it, there's no other way than to create an address for each transaction. If you don't, there's no way to correlate incoming payments with orders. Mm-hmm. So you assign when somebody goes to checkout, you generate a new Bitcoin address and you associate the shopping cart record with that address, and then you wait for a payment. That address doesn't get reused.
Correct. Now, one person or some people may say, well, I'm just accepting donations and they're anonymous donations and I don't need to verify who it came from because I'm not sending out products to them or anything. Well, the issue that we're talking about here is also anonymity, and that is of your transaction. If you want it to be publicly known how much you have received, I mean, you can get
right.
that information, you know, that's going to be there. Also, the reverse is also possible. If you need a system
where it needs to be publicly auditable how much money has been paid to you, how many bitcoins have been paid. You can have an account that you can see how many coins have been actually paid to you to show. It's sort of like a public receipt. And there could be some use cases for that. I know there are, but I'm not getting to them right now. But
you can't correlate that with a wallet balance, but you can see it in the aggregate for the address.
Okay. So on this Bitcoin, the bit laundry, this is a back to your projects with the shopping carts. People can find this stuff on – is all this code on GitHub?
Yes. The three shopping cart plugins, github.com/MikeGogolsky, as well as a Bitcoin PHP library that I developed in the process of doing these and that I need to update for the recent changes to the API.
Okay. And what changes would those be?
Additional features being added to the JSON RPC HTTP interface. There have been, for example, the latest version of Bitcoin supports sending out. I'm trying to think now. There's a send many command that's been added that allows you to specify in a single RPC request to the Bitcoin wallet to make multiple spends out of the wallet. Okay. And some of the Bitcoin mining pool operators are now using this.
Ah, okay. Interesting. Nice. The Bitcoin the bit laundry and the Bitcoin the Bitcoin laundry and app.bitlaundry.com, those are services only. They're not code.
The code is private. I mean, the right, code is right. my property, and I ain't gonna publish it.
Right. Okay. So yeah, these are just services that you have. What's this app? How come there's this app at the beginning? App.bitlaundry.com. I'm just curious as a developer why you have that on there.
Well, app.bitlaundry.com actually runs on Google App Engine. And I believe that you can't point a naked domain to it. Or if you can, then I've got to do a little bit of reading about the system and rejigger things, so that it would have a more sensible address, either just bitlaundry.com or www.bitlaundry.com.
Okay, so this is running this app is running inside the Google App Cloud.
That's correct.
Okay, is Bitcoin running in there also?
No.
Bitcoin's running remotely.
Yeah, Bitcoin runs somewhere else.
Okay, so this is only processing the orders, incoming order placements.
Yeah, well, the website talks to users on the one end, and then through the RPC API, talks to the Bitcoin wallet that's running elsewhere.
Ah, interesting. Okay. Let's see. There's a lot of talk lately about running these things, a lot of applications in clouds, and there are some things that can be done, but maybe this is for another show. Yesterday, inside of the Agora channel, fellow traveler was talking about running stuff on untrusted servers, and he has these ideas for running things on untrusted servers that provide a valuable service without compromising any type of privacy of what is happening with the transactions. So it gives what he's talking about is that you could go out there. There's an incentive now that he has set up for Bitcoin, for people involved with Bitcoin, to go out there and to get put up servers and to put up their own servers, dedicated servers, virtual private servers, or shared hosting, or I don't know where the stuff will run. But the point is that you can run this stuff on a server that is in a completely insecure, you can consider it a completely insecure server, and the service that it provides, you can gain, there's an economic incentive where you can gain money by being part mm-hmm. of it and not compromised. It's a pretty fascinating thing, because a lot of these things you have to really control the hardware and everything.
I like the way that fellow traveler thinks. I follow his GitHub commits a little bit, and I was quite excited when I saw him starting to integrate Bitcoin as a mechanism into open transactions. I thought that was really exciting.
Oh yeah. He's really hot on this. You know, I read a quote, a post by Hal Finney from 97, I think it was, and he was talking about, he was looking at the Bitcoin stuff, and he brought up in there in his article the same thing that fellow traveler has been pushing, and that is, Hal said that he saw this great need that Bitcoin was fulfilling, but also this other part of anonymous digital cash systems that can be tied in with it to give something where both of them bring something to the table. And a lot of people haven't been talking about that. Fellow traveler has been more than anyone, and he's working on it. He's actually doing it. He's not just talking about it. So I see a lot of interesting systems coming out of this, just like your BitLaundry.com. I have a suggestion for your app, bitlaundry.com, as a business model.
You want to hold off on that for just a sec?
Yeah, sure.
The Hal Finney thing, I believe, was a response to Satoshi Nakamoto on a cryptography mailing list. It was 2008, not 1997.
Oh, yes. Yeah, correct.
You know, and the interesting thing is that when you look at, you know, how the different virtual currency systems have been set up, typically you've got an issuer who issues a currency and says it's backed by a certain asset. But in order to gain popularity and reputation, that issuer has to be continuously able and willing to redeem the virtual currency for the asset. Now Bitcoin is that asset, and it's one that everybody can use. And that's, I think that's the real magic.
Yeah, it is. I have a little thing here. Let's get back to this Bitcoin as an asset in as a backing asset in a moment. I need to load up my email program here to pull up this a partial quote from a fellow traveler on one of the mailing lists yesterday. We'll get to that in 1 second. Oh, here it is. Stand by. Let me pull this up here. It's very relevant. Just a moment. And here we go. Okay, fellow traveler, this is a great post that he put in here, because a lot of people are talking about what's going on inside the markets for Bitcoin value shooting up and down and where it's going and trying to calculate how much Bitcoin's going to be worth when it's not tied to, you know, like a gold standard or something. And fellow traveler has this great theory here, his little opinion. He says, I posit that the value of Bitcoins comes from their unique properties, that they are publicly auditable, and that they cannot be counterfeited, confiscated, or shut down. And he continues, I theorize that ultimately the percentage of overall value that ends up actually being stored in Bitcoins will be proportionate to the value that Bitcoin actually adds to the global monetary system by virtue of its unique properties. I don't expect it to be used as a storage medium per se, but more as a transfer medium and monetary lubricant between other currencies and transaction servers.
Interesting.
Yes. So now, if it does have super value as he sees it as a transfer medium, then that value itself can be used as a storage medium because, you know, it has such a high value. But that point there that he talks about, that it's going to be proportionate to the value that it actually brings to So, you know, I think that for me, the value of it for me is continuing to rise, not because of what someone's going to give. It's not necessarily because I can get $5 out of it, but because of how useful it is in plugging in and starting this anonymous digital cash systems and these Bitcoin, you know, like your system with the laundry, and then to be able to send transactions back and forth. And another guy posted, John Matonis posted a quote from somebody, which is also an interesting frame to look at this. And he said, Bitcoin does not replace PayPal. It replaces Hawala, which is
right.
Which is an all, which is not, all of these things aren't necessarily, you know, true. I mean, they're all very fascinating and interesting frames that may be, you know, unique perspectives from looking at what it really does.
So, right. But yeah, you've got, it does have that kind of, you know, fluidity aspect. That's a major added value. I mean, for example, if, you know, I live in Slovakia, if I wanted to hire a PHP programmer in Kathmandu, ordinarily, how would I pay the guy? You know, sending money through the banking system would be a disaster in conversion fees and delays and everything else.
Yeah.
With Bitcoin, you know, it's effectively instant.
Right. You know, let's go back over to with PayPal. A lot of people think, oh, in my PayPal account, I have, you know, $200. And or they say, in my bank account, I have $200, when they don't. What they have, Ray Servers is real big on this, they have dollar liabilities at the bank. At PayPal,
that's right.
They have dollar liabilities. Now, I could open up, right now, I could go into the Loom system and open up Agorist Radio bucks, and I could say they're dollars. And you send me money, and I have dollar liabilities. Now, you could say, well, if I have dollars at Agorist Radio, I have dollars in PayPal, and I have dollars in my pocket, that's all the same. It's all dollars. No, it's not.
No, it's not.
Because in my pocket, I actually do have dollars. Now, debating what those are really worth in the market, that's something else. But I have dollars in my pocket. At the bank, I have liabilities. Now, some banks are more... Those liabilities are going to be worth more than other banks, and then because you know the bank at Agorist Radio, you know, who knows is behind that and what's going on? You know, there's these trust issues.
So you it have depends on the reserve ratio. Yeah.
Right, and how and people trusting whoever's you know actually running the operation and whether it's worked for them before. So with PayPal right now. For PayPal, why do PayPal – because remember, you don't have PayPal dollars. You have PayPal dollar liabilities. So why are PayPal bucks so popular and so worth to most people? They really are worth a dollar in your pocket. It's the same type of a thing. The value that they provide for instantaneous payment for between most of the people that are – and I don't know how – billion people or 500 million or whatever they have using their system – that you can send money back and forth so fast and simply, you know, with an email address, you know, aside from setting up your account and account verification. So, you know, you get back to this thing with the Bitcoin, all of a sudden it's like this thing with a fellow traveler saying it's the value of it starts to skyrocket based upon its properties, not necessarily because of some inherent value that is there, just like PayPal bucks are nothing. They're just a liability.
And that's probably a more realistic view than one that I had a couple of months ago. I had this kind of fever dream imagining that Bitcoin supplants all monetary systems globally. And then proceeded to ask myself the question, well, if that happened, what would one Bitcoin be worth? And I got back into talking about this on a forum thread yesterday. And at the time, I had come up with a number that was $50,000, based on an estimate of based on an estimate of global M3. Well, it turns out that I did my math totally wrong. If Bitcoin replaced all currency worldwide based on M3, actually one Bitcoin would be worth something like $2.6 million.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
That's still a fever dream.
Yeah, right, yeah. No. Yeah, and the other thing is that the value of the Bitcoin cannot what did you say that it was going to, in that theory, was possibly supplanting all? What was the word you used?
Yeah, I imagine Bitcoin supplanting all other currencies.
Right. Now, I don't.
Yeah. Imagine a planet Earth with an economy that's based exclusively on Bitcoin as a monetary instrument.
Yeah. Well, when you start getting into Loom and other things, you start seeing that everything is a monetary. If two people agree to use it in exchange, it's a monetary instrument. You know, so anything can be. One thing it will do is it will be disruptive to every single monetary instrument that has ever been used and ever will be used. Not necessarily supplanting it, but it's going to be disruptive to its current ingrained model. The way that things are, so much stuff that's used today is used not because people want to use it, but because that's the only way that they can perform certain transactions. The biggest example is like the petrodollar. You know, do people really want to hold the dollar all over the world as much as they do? No. They need to do things like purchase oil. And if they do that, they have to hold massive reserves. So these models of usage start to change, and then their support mechanisms start to fall, or the support mechanisms like the Huala system start to raise, you know. So
and just like the petrodollar, for example, if you operate a small business in Europe, and it comes time to pay the health insurance premium and social insurance for your employees, the only asset that you can use to pay that is the euro.
Okay. Right. Yeah. Exactly.
You know, that's part of its ultimate backing, is the obligation to pay taxes to the state.
Yes.
in the legal tender currency.
Yeah. Okay. Well, you know, back to this Bitcoin app.bitlaundry.com. What you have here is a system that is very similar to a single. It's similar, okay, to a single node anonymous remailer, where you're giving a delay and then you're specifying recipients. Now, of course, this is not, you know, there's not, information is not necessarily encrypted and this, there's different things that are different. But if you I could see a business model opportunity here where you could license out your software to other Bitcoin, to other BitLaundry operators, and where they could be part of a chain. So,
well, I've thought of that too, and before I think about licensing it out to people, what I would do is I would be setting up multiple different instances of it myself, and run a closed network to provide for multiple hops. But with the auditability of the Bitcoin blockchain, it doesn't really achieve too terribly much to add lots and lots more transactions into the mix. The real key is being able to swap incoming Bitcoins for new ones at the other end.
Yeah. Well, yeah, that's what I was thinking in this type of a system. I mean, one thing, though, is that when you're running them all yourself, the problem with that is people... No, it's not a problem because, you know, it can still add something to it. But if the operators are, it's sort of like if one person was running all the Tor servers, you'd have the ability to do more collusion. I can see with open transactions, he's working on some stuff with the Bitcoin system. You start getting into stuff like Ripple, and then I could see that tying in with your BitLaundry stuff here really nicely for doing multiple cascading exchanges of coins and ownership and payment IDs and everything. So anyway,
yeah, I'd have to do some more thinking about that. The limiting factor to how much of that you can do is the transaction fees that the Bitcoin network will demand for certain types of transactions or at certain times. when the current backlog of transactions becomes large enough and the block is still being generated, the network will demand a transaction fee. And right now that fee can be as low as 0.0005 bitcoins, I think. Uh-huh. Which is pretty cheap, and which is doable. But the network, in fact, often demands 0.1 or 0.3, in which case, you know, when I'm only working on a 0.5% commission basis, the profit opportunity for the service operator disappears pretty quickly.
Yeah, yeah. Well, also there's the demand. Right now, a lot of people don't understand the implications of the lack of anonymity in the system. And I think as we start to see governments and other police agencies and everything basically doing one of these, you know, SIG to DOT PGP keyring linking of visual graphic, you know, type stuff where they have this massive, you know, 3D OpenGL like linking thing with all the IDs hooked up with websites and IDs. I mean, people, there's some, I forget the name of the website. There is a guy right now that has a blockchain explorer or something like that. You can go
it's, in. It's called explorer.com, and it's operated by the Belgamos.
What was that? We had a connection issue.
Dropout. It's called blockexplorer.com, and it's operated by the Bitcoin Forum member named Thamos.
Yeah. Yeah, so this type of stuff, this type of awareness needs to grow a little bit more, and then a lot of these services, I think there's going to be a demand for them, a much higher demand where people are pretty much going to want to either be exchanging as much as possible outside of the system, and then using systems like your Bitcoin thing. Hey, look, you brought up mining. Okay, let's see. You know, you brought up the mining. Let's talk about that. You said that you're actually getting into this mining. A lot of people are getting out of it because there's no. It's hard to do without a GPU. When a project first started up, everybody that downloaded it was, you know, mining. Now most people are getting out than are getting into it. So what are you doing?
Well, first of all, I'm going out right now, and I placed an order for four mining systems, each with two graphics cards, each card having two GPUs each. And those should be coming in next week, and I'm going to set them up in the other room here. I'm not going to say exactly what year I'm getting, but suffice it to say for the listeners that it'll generate enough heat so that I probably won't have to put the radiators on next winter.
Wait, you said you're not going to say what year, or what did you say?
What equipment? What year?
What do you mean by what year?
No, what gear?
Oh,
what
gear. Equipment? Oh, yeah. Sorry, I didn't hear that. That threw me off there. Oh, yeah. Oh, that's awesome. So, what do you? There's a business model there for you. You see, in mining.
Well, you know, I've got this spreadsheet that you know takes the mining difficulty and the price that I pay in Slovakia for electricity, and the power draw of the graphics cards and the costs of all the equipment, and the current MTGOX U.S. dollar to Bitcoin exchange rate. And make some assumptions, and then, you know, kind of lays out a course of saying, okay, I start with this amount of machines, and I make this much in the first month, and then I take the profit, and I push it back in, and I buy more machines, et cetera.
Oh, wow. Fantastic. Now, are you...
And there's people out there that are doing this.
Are you going cowboy on this, or are you going in a pool?
Initially, I'm going to be in a pool. It's the only sensible thing to do starting out at this level is to start out in a pool.
Why don't you tell us why with your research?
Well, because right now the Bitcoin network, when I last looked, has something like 1.6 terahashes per second available in total computing power. Uh-huh. I'm going to have something like, let's see, when I start, 8 times 600. I'll have maybe 5 gigahashes per second. So if I went solo, my chance of generating a block and collecting 50 bitcoins for each block is very, very small.
Because it's a race, however, correct?
It's a race,
right.
Yeah.
Right.
However, the pool that I intend to join is deepbit.net, and that pool by itself is about 1 terahash per second. So jump into the biggest pool and collect the shared earnings from that. Now, later on, if I can get a terahash myself, then I'll go solo.
Ah, okay. Now, did you investigate many of the other? I see pools are popping up left and right now. Have you investigated some of the other ones? And any other ones that you think are interesting, or why you went with these guys? Besides, are they just the most powerful right now, or near the top, or what?
Yeah, I've looked at a few of the other ones. DeepBit was, I think, was one of the first to really innovate in terms of how the pool provides feedback to miners to say, okay, you can stop working on the current block now because it's already been solved. there was a problem where pool miners would continue trying to hash a block even after the network had solved it. So there was a lot of wasted time and lost efficiency.
Yeah, can you imagine the miners' union with that in meat space if that happened?
Yeah, right. But in any case, now the other pools have implemented that capability, but DeepBit is simply the biggest. So as far as I can tell, it's the place to be.
Oh, okay. Now, well, the thing is that the trade-off is that if it's the biggest, then you're getting a smaller piece of the pie.
Yeah, but I'm getting a constant rate.
Right, 'cause the other ones are
relative to the, how much of the total network DeepBit controls, as a percentage, I get a generation rate based on that.
Okay, so I have a question then. Why isn't all of the other mining operations just shutting down and joining DeepNet?
Well, I think some of them have shut down, but other ones are popping up. Honestly, I don't know. I haven't looked in great depth at the pooled mining marketplace. I know there's another one called, it's called like Bitcoin Pooled, something.cz, Czech Republic domain, that's pretty popular, but it only has something like 300 gigahashes. Hashes per second.
Yeah.
And now I've seen announcements that there's new ones starting up, and then there's apparently one guy out there somewhere named he calls himself Artforce, who's got custom FPGA chips that are doing massive amounts of hashing, and apparently he runs solo.
Wow, fascinating. Yeah, I want to do a show coming up soon, just dedicated to what's going on inside the mining stuff, because with the pools, because the whole economics start to change when it's not just this a single guy, everyone just like competing with what they have inside their house or their CPUs, and they're joining up together, and this these new chips and everything, it's pretty fascinating. Well,
CPU mining is effectively dead. I mean, you compare what you can get from a top-of-the-line graphics card versus a top-of-the-line CPU, and the difference is something like, 500 times better on the graphics card.
Yeah. Do you know right now what it is at this moment? How much time for, a regular PC with a modern chipset in it? How long it would take to...
Many years. Many years. Like, more than 10.
Yeah. That's something else.
Because you're competing against what's effectively an enormous distributed supercomputer.
Yeah.
In the last couple of days, I've seen this estimate that says now the combined computing power that's being devoted to mining bitcoins exceeds the sum of the computing power of the top half of the top 500 supercomputers in the world.
Really?
Yeah.
Absolutely fascinating. Hey, if you That's have a link to that, or you know the source of that, send that over. I'll throw that into the show notes.
I sure will.
There was a couple of other topics that we were going to get into, but it's late in the show, and I think it would take away from the fantastic show that we've had already, and I would like to ask if we can cover those on a different show.
You bet.
Okay. Well, we have a few minutes left here. Is there anything else that you find interesting going on with all the Bitcoin stuff, or that you've been reading about, or you want to talk about before we take off here in a little bit?
Well, I mean, the thing that most excites me about it is, first there's the notion that, you know, geez, I should have gotten into this in 2009. Darn it, you know. If only I'd heard of it then and understood it. Of course, hindsight is 2020. But what's really been exciting is the growth in attention since the beginning of the year. The way that the market has shaped up. We'd had Bitcoins trading as high as $9 each in the past month, and something like $4 million worth of value has exchanged hands just on the MT Gox exchange in the last 30 days. Amazing.
Yeah.
There's now an alternative currency ecosystem that's worth in excess of $40 million. As far as I know, that hasn't really happened before.
Yeah, right. Well, you know, if you do the talk about the hindsight thing, if you did get into this when you first heard about it, a couple of years ago, even the middle of last year, and you thought to yourself, this is fantastic, you would have been speculating not on the value of Bitcoin, but what you would have been speculating more on is that it was going to take off. Because until people started getting into it, it was just an academic exercise.
That's right. It was just a hobby for a lot of people.
So but the moment that one person said, I will give you services or goods, and then another guy, whether the goods are going to be dollars, but that it could actually be used to conduct an economic transaction. That's when the spark started to fly. And when I was visiting the Bitcoin website and I saw the merchant page, the first couple of times I saw that page, there was just a couple of people there. And then it started growing. And then the number of websites and the entire ecosystem around it exploding, as that started happening, that in my mind, the value of Bitcoin was proportional to that, not necessarily because some stock market says that it was worth $9. Of course, that reflects it all, but that's where I saw, wow, okay, you know, I can start selling services and accept it, and if I get it. Like people say, well, you know, you can't eat gold, you know. Well, you can't eat Bitcoin, but you know what? If I can accept it for my goods and my services, and what am I going to do with it? Well, I can get it, you know, to get an exchanger. Like right now, a lot of the DGCs, in order to get it out of the system, you have to go to an exchanger. And then a lot of these exchangers want passports and everything. That's fine.
Yep.
But I find more useful is when I can accept it for in payment for goods and services, and then when the ecosystem is so big that a lot of my outgoing money, I can use that to pay for, you know, servers or freeze-dried food or I don't know, all of the different things that people are starting to use it for. And I think that's going to start to exponentially grow also.
Yeah, well, that's when the magic happens, you know, when you can start paying your internet service bill or your grocery bill with Bitcoin. That's going to be a major inflection point. But now that marketplace forum is the biggest one on the Bitcoin.org site, and in other places too. You've got, what is it, like BitcoinJobs.com. You've got people posting work and themselves as offering services for Bitcoin, programming, technical writing, translation, all kinds of different things. So there's a marketplace growing up all over, kind of willy-nilly right now. We have no idea what it's going to look like in a couple of years.
Oh, yeah. Oh, here's this website I wanted to bring up I ran across the other day. Because I'm real big on this P2P, Hawala, whatever you want to call it, the OTC, over-the-counter. I think that is going to be – that's going to be the number one catalyst for – massive explosion inside this entire system is when anyone and everyone that you know, or at least many people, or a single person within everybody's circle of friends is buying and selling Bitcoins, okay? Just like, you know, dime bags or whatever, but on a scale much bigger than that, huge, okay, where there's a local guy right there that you know, and he's doing it. And this new site popped up called Ubitex. U-B-I-T-E-X, ubitex.org. What is Ubitex? Ubitex is a new way, I'm going to quote, just read it, a new way to buy and sell Bitcoins for cash. Instead of using PayPal, which could end in chargebacks, frozen accounts, and all sorts of scams, Ubitex makes it easy for you to meet someone in person and do the transaction face-to-face. And since you pay in cash, face-to-face fraud is nearly eliminated.
If you're buying Bitcoin, and they had an IPO.
Oh, Ubitex did?
Ubitex had an IPO, yeah.
Oh. Yeah, let me finish here and tell me about it because I haven't read other stuff on it. If you're buying Bitcoins, all you have to do is enter your zip code, cross street or city, and Ubitex will show you users looking to sell near you. Choose a seller and a private conversation begins between the two of you without your information being released to either party by Ubitex. It's both safe and secure. If you're looking to sell Bitcoins, Ubitex will add you to the list of sellers in your area. It's as simple as that. And up here they have sellers near me. You click on that, and you get nothing right now. But become a seller. You enter an I want to sell, and then you have a location for an amount, and it shows U.S. dollar, Bitcoin, Canadian dollar, all of these things, four, and then it shows the same list of currencies to someone within X number of kilometers, and then of me. And then you enter that thing, and oh, my God. Gosh, I mean, the implications of where this is going, and I don't know what's going to happen with Ubitex, okay, but what they are doing is just the beginning of something. I mean, you talk about disruptive technology and speech, you know, money as speech and individuals networking worldwide without any type of a middleman happening between them. This is unstoppable. Well, tell us what you know about Ubitex with their IPO.
Yeah, it's very interesting. Very interesting concept. I hope it succeeds. They had a couple of weeks ago. They announced they were going to have an IPO for the company. They sold 1,000 shares for one Bitcoin each via a site called the Global Bitcoin Stock Exchange, which is GLBSE.com, which uses. It's like XML representations of Ricardian contracts or something like this. And I was going to buy in for a few bitcoins, but the exchange was down over the weekend. And by the time I woke up on Monday or whenever it is, it had reopened. The offering was sold out. No. I couldn't get in. So they raised 1,000 bitcoins in equity.
Okay,
just on the strength of an idea.
This is awesome. Let's take this to the next level. They didn't just sell shares out there in the wild. They sold it on GLBSE. And Nefaria was in the channel last night, and he was saying that the site was down. I don't know if it's up now, but they found some bug, and they're working it out. But do you know what the current share price is going on the GLBSE for Ubitex shares? Have you seen that?
No, I haven't looked in a while.
See, that's what's funny is they do the IPO 1,000. It's in GLBSE, and then you have another market happening there about their shares. And if you wanted to buy it, but they were gone before you could purchase it, that shows that there's a market above the one Bitcoin per share price. I bet right now on the GLBSE, it's going for more than the original Bitcoin per share.
Maybe so, or maybe people don't value it that highly because in the meanwhile the value of Bitcoins has gone from $3 each to $7 each.
Oh, there you go.
You know, so maybe it trades lower.
Yeah.
It is a market.
Yeah, there you go. So this stuff is going to go all over the place. Well, you talk about
and it's a chaos it's kind rates. Of an epiphenomenon of the Bitcoin market. You know, now you can trade shares in different stocks. Now that's a derivative market.
Yeah. Yeah. I can see these Ubitex guys also like tying. I mean, it's not really that anonymous of a system. I mean, it's okay right now probably for most people. But as soon as the terrorocrats like say anything and everything Bitcoin is illegal, if you even utter the word Bitcoin, it's a criminal. You know, to that point, a system like this kind of as it's implemented falls on its face, because at that point it's almost like having a drugs.ubitex.org where you say, I want to buy weed for blah, blah, blah within this area. And then, you know, sure. The people that you hook up with are all narcs, you know, that are in that are in the system. But as it is now, this is completely, I don't know how legal it is. I think it's
not yet illegal.
Yeah. I mean, because it's not saying I will exchange and be a money transmitter. They're literally saying I want to buy. It's like saying I will buy gold coins, or if you are selling gold coins, I want to buy them or whatever. And this,
it's a matchmaking service.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. You know, so that's perfectly fine. I can see this tying in, you know, these services tying in with something like Foursquare, which, you know, I have problems.
Yes.
But a lot of people use that where it's like, you know, within, you know how Foursquare works with your location.
Yep.
and you know, meeting, hooking up and showing who's close to you and all this type of stuff with all this P2P stuff going on. It's I found that before. This is the little idea here. A lot of the stuff with Twitter and Facebook, everyone's throwing all this stuff out there, and they're not using encryption and block and protecting their IP. And a lot of them are throwing a lot of stuff out there. It's just way too much. But at the same time, that same system is also, even though it may be out there in the open and completely viewable and monitored and tracking and all this stuff, at the same time, they're P2P in and of itself, even without crypto, even without anonymity and all this type of stuff, it's still a disruptive technology. So,
oh, it sure is.
You know, just the very fact of everyone out there just talking in the public about some event or idea or whatever, it's still super powerful. So who knows where these systems are going to go, how deep in the underground they're going to need to be pushed, but they're going to thrive. And every other day, you know, these apps that are popping up. You know, in the past it was pretty much eGold and Pecunix, and then a bunch of people who had shopping carts on their websites for this stuff. But in this Bitcoin system, you know, you got stuff like your BitLaundry and this Ubitex and the GLBSE, all of these things. This ecosystem is just way, way, way bigger than just, you know, logging into your PayPal-type Bitcoin website to make a transaction. So it's exciting times.
Yeah, and it's something that goes, you know, that goes beyond the kind of gold bug fascination with, you know, metal assets and things like this, because it's peer-to-peer. I mean, that's what's gotten so many people excited about it, I think, is that there is no centralization.
Yeah, right.
And I'm looking forward to a day. Here's another kind of disruptor or inflection point is, you know, instead of getting a Christmas card from your mother with a $50 or $100 check in it, one day you get a Bitcoin scratch card. 5 bitcoins, you know, scratch the card, you get your unique QR code from an issuer, and you can redeem it online.
Yeah. No, it's great. What's great about stuff like that is that it's a sort of like a viral marketing campaign type of a thing, because what you're doing is you're not just sending money to someone that has a Bitcoin. You're actually giving them like this gift certificate type thing. You're throwing them into the economy. Oh, I got it now. What am I going to do with it? I need this somewhere.
Yeah. Well, that's how I got into it. Is a friend of mine, one of the guys I host a blog for, Anthony Martin, went to mybitcoin.com, which is a service that lets you basically send bitcoins to an email address. So it's kind of like the PayPal for Bitcoin.
Okay.
So he sent me 10 bitcoins back in November and said, Mike, you should check this out. It's cool. And I guess he had acquired some by mining. So I redeemed them and I started reading about Bitcoin and blah, blah, blah. I said, yeah, you know, that's exactly how this thing spreads.
Oh, that's great. That's great. You know, we mentioned something on this the other day. Someone had posted an article in the Agora channel yesterday about how the cypherpunks, no getting a free lunch from the cypherpunks, and how the people that were behind the cypherpunk stuff, they went into other businesses because no one was paying them. And the whole idea was there was no economic incentive, and that's the reason why there's not been such progress in these projects and the like. And I can see some element of some elements of those ideas and some of the problems. But I think that it's also it's sort of like the guy who says I can't, who's sitting in his house playing PlayStation in a way, or I don't know if it's necessarily that, but and he's sitting there saying that he can't afford it because he can't get a job. Instead of like going and seeing what food he has in the refrigerator and then preparing it and then going out in the street and selling it.
Right.
You know, stuff as an example. So back to something that we talked a little bit last night is that if 10 years ago you said, how long until 1 billion people are using Usenet? 10 years ago, you said, how long until we get 1 billion people to use Usenet? And then, you know, you'd have all these engineers and software guys and programmers and these experts and stuff and TCP.
People who have read A Fire Upon the Deep.
Yeah.
Right. And got excited about a galaxy-spanning Usenet.
Yeah, and all this. Exactly. So, all you know, and they're sitting there and saying, well, when we have this, it's going to be great. But then what they're giving everybody is Usenet. Now, you know, Usenet for what Usenet did and stuff is fantastic. I mean, there's still some great things about Usenet that aren't being used right now as far as information broadcasting and stuff. So I'm not going to bash it. But if you're talking about how long till we get 1 billion people using it, that's a different question. The same thing with the cypherpunk programs in the past. It's not about how cool it is. It's about how long until we can get this many people using it and get the critical mass that's necessary. And so the question back 10 years ago on Usenet, how long till we get 1 billion people? Well, here's the answer. Never. It ain't going to happen. But then you have – and then so then the cypherpunks supposedly go off – these guys, most of them at least, go off and just get real jobs and then focus on other stuff. And a lot of them didn't do anything but talking in the first place. But – a lot of them did do some stuff, but they went off into nothingness. Another and said, no one's paying. There's no money in it, and blah, blah, blah. Okay. Then you have fast forward another 10 years, and you got someone like Mark Zuckerberg who and whatever ideas he stole or whatever. I don't know the whole story, but let's just use him as an example. You have him come out, and then he creates a system, and he gets 1 billion people to use it in a year or 2 years or whatever it is. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
Now – what's the lesson here? Is it, well, we're never going to get 1 billion people to use Usenet because why? Because people aren't interested in it? No, it was the interface. It was the network. And the interface is not necessarily the graphical interface. It's the interface.
Well, and it was just the wrong question. I mean, you know, it was just the wrong kind of question.
Right. So I see.
So is Usenet the right application? No, it wasn't the right application for 1 billion people to use.
Right, so the same thing right now with this stuff we're seeing is that you could say, well, how can we get 1 billion people to be exchanging gold? How are we going to get them all to use e-gold or Pecunix or these systems? And then there's the failures, and then there's a lot of gun-shy people out there to get into these systems. But then you get into the Bitcoin thing, and then you have people saying, how long until we have 1 billion people using Bitcoin? Well, you know what? Just using the Bitcoin interface as it is right now, maybe never.
Okay? Maybe never.
Maybe never, okay? But if we're just using the Bitcoin interface, there may still be enough people, and there already is, and it's growing very fast right now, that are willing to use these current interfaces, just like they did with Usenet, and that system may survive great, and it may be very useful to everyone that's involved with it, but it may never go beyond that. But what I'm seeing happening, the ecosystem here is growing so fast that I see the possibility where with Bitcoin and these digital cash systems being merged together and integrated with their strengths and weaknesses, we may have within a year and 2 years, just like Facebook, 1 billion people using Bitcoin, and they won't be using it like they used Usenet. They'll be using it like they use Facebook now. They just have this simple interface, and it works. And the magic that happens in the background, it doesn't even matter. Bitcoin built digital cash built into the P2P clients. People don't even know that it's going on. Well, maybe they do because they know that when I use this application and when I run this program, I'm making money or I'm doing this and I'm doing that. But there's these Facebook is sort of like a meta Usenet interface, not necessarily the technology, but the usability. So we may be seeing with the way that these projects are popping up and the creativity that's going into it, we may see 1 billion people in the next couple of years. It's all up to being. Oh, back to my point. It was that.
Well, I think you're right on here, and I can see emerging services like Bitcoin online banks, for example, as filling a gap in the market space to bring more users into the ecosystem when they're not going to use they're not going to run the client on their PC all the time. And plus that, how long until there's a Bitcoin application for Facebook?
Yeah.
Maybe never.
Well, yeah, maybe never. But that could also be the Facebook killer.
Yeah.
Is another alternate network like the Diaspora and the Open Status and some of these other systems that actually come up with something that has this massive economic incentive where it's just a matter of clicking a couple of buttons and you got invites going to your friends and money's flying all over the place. That it's I don't think that the issue is the problem is people just don't care. Okay. I don't think that that's the problem.
No, that's not the issue.
It's like you said, it's asking the wrong question. It's that the innovators have not been creative enough in order to fulfill a particular market need or to present a solution to a market need that is out there that people don't even realize that they even had. I mean, people weren't sitting around like, oh, I wish I had Facebook, That Facebook, if I had Facebook, it would be really cool. No, they presented it, and then bam, it happened. So I think that's where this stuff is going. Because right now, more than ever, people have realized that the banksters are scamming them over, the current monetary systems, not even libertarian-type-minded individualist people. We're talking people on all spectrums are saying, this ain't working. We're looking for new ideas. And they're all open up to all this new P2P and new disruptive technology. It's the natural thing. Everyone that's growing up now is just seeing this stuff going, and they're ready to jump onto something new.
Well, I think too, when you're thinking about this kind of thing, you got to look at a Facebook epiphenomenon, and you got to say to yourself, how in the hell did Zynga Corporation, the inventors of Farmville, achieve multi-millions in valuation? How is it that they generated millions of dollars in revenue, and they provided a simple product that people liked. They wanted to play the game, and they had an economic incentive for people to spend money on it. They're raking it in.
Yeah,
tremendous.
Yeah,
I played Farmville for a couple of months myself. Eventually, I said, okay, well, this is a very simple kind of optimization problem. It's kind of like trade wars come back every day, and but. For whatever reason, they got the usability hook, and they got people coming back and spreading it for them.
Yeah, right. Well, so what you're saying there is the idea is don't necessarily people shouldn't be just focusing on like how can I make money with Bitcoin in some of the traditional ways of trying to make money with systems that have to do with banking, okay? Maybe they need to be looking at what kind of, like you said, what kind of solutions are some of these people doing out there that we can mirror or tie into and then throw this economic incentive in, and then throw it in a way that is not just, you know, where you're going to get coupons and discounts on special prizes and things like that, like a lot of these social gaming systems, but where people are actually. So, hey, that may be it. That may be the next killer. That may be a killer Bitcoin thing, is the social gaming.
I mean, quite possibly. There's already a Bitcoin RPG out there. I haven't looked at it. I don't know how it's doing, but it's out there.
Well, you know, the same thing. There's a lot of there's a ton of these Bitcoin gambling and stuff like that. But like what you said, it's different. There's been a lot of games you can go out. There's 1,000 games out there that you can go and you can get to do stuff like games like Farmville that you can download and play on your machine. But when you get into the social gaming, then all of a sudden you're getting away from like the Usenet system and then getting into something that is this Facebook type phenomenon.
So you really have it in for Usenet, you know. You really have it in for Usenet.
Yeah. No, I just think the perfect analogy is Usenet to Facebook for what all the cypherpunks have been pushing over the years to where we could be and where things could be going real soon with proper some new solutions like the Facebook solution to the Usenet problem.
I'm reminded of an old quote attributed, I believe, to Gene Spafford, one of the original developers of Usenet. Because I was on Usenet back in like 1990 or 89, something. And Spafford wrote, echoing, I believe it was Marshall McLuhan, Usenet is a vast wasteland. Now, of course, you know, well, Usenet is still a wasteland. It's not nearly as vast. Facebook is definitely now the new vast wasteland.
Yeah. Well, that's okay. The internet as a whole is a vast wasteland. It's just more about the making good connections and mining the good information nuggets out there for analogy. Well,
yeah, of course, back in 89, Usenet kind of was synonymous with the internet. But anyway,
yeah. What was your earliest internet experience before we close out here?
Dialing into an unsecured terminal server at the local university and telnetting to, God, I don't even remember.
Yeah,
I don't even remember. But later on, there were public access Unix systems in the Orlando area. People that operated them as a hobby, and they gave people accounts for free.
Yeah.
And so I would read Usenet on some of those systems.
Yeah. Oh, that's great. I remember using doing the same thing, dialing in and doing the telnet stuff and Gopher and
oh yeah. But I mean these weren't even internet hosts. These were UUCP hosts.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, that's well, I was on. Well, that's for another topic, nostalgic stuff. Hey, this has been a fantastic episode. I think we'll close it up here. And is there anything you wanted to say? I like to give guests the last word before we take off here.
I'm very, very much looking forward to my indictment for laundering bitcoins.
Oh man!
Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Mike. We'll talk to you soon.
It's been a pleasure.
All right, everyone, another great episode of Cypherpunked. We'll close out here with the Crystal Method, ready for action.
Dodge this.
This is Hero White of the Cypherpunk Show. AgoristRadio.com is sponsored by MetroPipe.net, SSH proxy and VPN services. Privacy is your right, only if you defend it. Please support our sponsors and tell others about them.
Broadcasting from deep within the second realm, you are listening to agoristradio.com.